flashing hand signals that some say are symbols of white supremacy. The city of Jax hosts a workshop on hate speech. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, a conversation with Jacksonville City Council member Leanna Cumber about hate speech in the 904. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, we'll tell you how the new group Lift Jax is working to eliminate generational poverty on the city's east side. Plus, some going green for you. Workshops on sea level rise and climate change coming up in the city. But first this hour, the latest numbers on the pandemic. The state reports the number of coronavirus cases increased by 3,615 yesterday to a total cumulative count of 1.83 million. Deaths rose to a tally of 28,934 statewide. Here's another number to throw at you. The number of Florida residents now vaccinated with at least one dose is 2.38 million. And let's hope that number keeps going up. And here are some more numbers to talk about. According to the Southern Poverty Law Center, there are now dozens of active hate groups in the state of Florida, nearly 70. And that includes seven of them in Duval County alone. Jacksonville City Council held a workshop last week about this. And the host of the initiative, member Leanna Cumber, said, "It's important for the city's elected leaders and residents to know about these hate groups and how hate symbols are being mainstreamed." At this event, the Anti-Defamation League, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, and the FBI also made presentations because for years now, federal law enforcement has identified white supremacist extremist groups as a major national security threat. This morning, we're taking a closer look as the City Council's Leanna Cumber joins us on the line. Councilwoman Cumber, good to have you on the show. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
And we're already getting your calls for Leanna Cumber of the Jacksonville City Council as she led an initiative on hate speech in Northeast Florida. What are your thoughts and comments about this? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. Leanna Cumber, what prompted you to take the lead on this and open up a public discussion about white supremacy, hate groups, and hate speech in our area?
Sure. Thanks for asking. So, back in early January, at our council meeting on January 12th, one of the public commenters, and we showed the three-minute public comment during the workshop, at the end of the 3 minutes, held up the okay sign, both hands up, kind of like goalposts, if you want a visual. And that symbol has been appropriated by white power groups. And so, I saw it. It happened pretty quickly. Went back and looked, and just decided that, we need to, if we're going to change the tone and the tenor of how people discuss, how people act in public forums and how we react to each other as Americans and so forth, we really need to start on the local level. And as the daughter of a Cuban exile, my husband's family's from Pakistan and Bangladesh, so we joke that our kids are like the model UN. These sorts of, hate symbols and these sorts of prejudices are really personal to me. And I think that it's difficult to have these conversations and to, some of these things are really hard to look at and to admit that we have them, in our communities, and they're becoming kind of mainstream, but it's really critical that we have these conversations and we have them in a forum like a Lunch and Learn so that there's nothing pending, so it doesn't become people trying to get a bill passed or so forth, but really just a community conversation to really get the education out there.
Dozens of these groups active in Florida, at least seven that we know of in Duval County alone. You had the feds at this event, the Homeland Security, the FBI, along with the Anti-Defamation League, they talked about this problem. It's a national security issue. What did we learn from the federal authorities at your event?
So this is a national security issue, and Homeland Security was there to talk about their threat bulletin. And then the FBI was there to talk about really when hate speech becomes a hate crime and talk a little bit about what they do here at home. You know, I always think I held a similar lunch and learn on sex trafficking about a year ago and had the FBI and Homeland Security there as well. I do think we have such great federal assets here at home that I think it's really important for us to connect with them so that we can all work together and give people a real holistic view of what's going on.
Okay. And then let me widen this out a little bit beyond Jacksonville, Councilwoman. The January 6th insurrection, the storming of the Capitol, featured a number of these groups. And so what are your thoughts about the outcome of that whole debacle? President Trump acquitted in the Senate of inciting an insurrection that was fomented in part by hate and white supremacist groups.
Sure. So, you know, I happened to be watching the count, the certification that day. And as a former Senate staffer, you know, as a mom, it was incredibly difficult to watch. Actually, my kids came home during everything. And so I sat my 9-year-old down and we talked about it and talked about this is, you know, these things are not why your grandparents left the countries that they left. This isn't how we handle differences of opinions here at home. And I think it's, you know, it's a good time to really start tackling these issues. And I think going forward, we need to focus on how we can all work together to, one, re-marginalize these groups, these hate groups. And they're not just white supremacist groups. They seem to kind of corner the market on it to some degree. But, you know, anti-LGBT groups, all sorts of hate groups. And we really need to start tackling it going forward and figuring out how we can all work together rather than kind of get in our corners and try to blame one another for what's happening, but figure out how we can work together to move forward and just make the country better.
And you're saying this as a Republican. This is a conversation going on largely on the Republican side when we're hearing Republicans like yourself saying we have to denounce extremism, we have to denounce xenophobia, we have to denounce white nationalism. On the other hand, many millions of Republicans who support former President Trump are on that extremist side. And so how is this civil war, as some have called it, within the Republican Party going to play out? And how do you plan to navigate that as an elected official?
Well, you know, a couple of things on that. It's a great question. Glad you asked it. A couple of things on that. One, I would think that the person who is most upset about the impeachment and the trial really is Vice President Harris. The fact that we now have a woman vice president and one who comes from very diverse backgrounds, it's monumental. And having a daughter, it really, regardless of me being a Republican and Vice President Harris being a Democrat, it is monumental. And I feel like that has really gotten lost in focusing on former President Trump. So, you know, I think it's important for Republicans to, you know, the messaging is right. The messaging is economic security, educational security, and personal security. I do think we have a messenger problem, and I think we have a messenger problem we don't have enough women in our party who are leaders and who, you know, and that's where we really need to focus, because the reality of it is those messages, if the message changes over years, over decades, but the messenger stays the same, then it's hard to really accept that. And so what I hope that I can do with the party is really bring in a more credible messenger. You know, I know what it's like to have kids and be a working mom and have to handle everything at home, everything at work, and so forth. And so I feel like women, it's really important for the Republican Party to understand that women need to have a really strong voice in the party if we're going to move forward.
Do you plan to extend your voice to a run for Jacksonville mayor?
Are you going to vote for me if I do?
I don't know. Maybe. Is it in your plans?
You know, I am right now. I'm very focused. I have a lot of things I'm focusing on in council. I just passed with 19-0 a new bill that changes how we regulate the adult novelty stores, and I have other bills coming up in the public safety realm. I'm really focused on that. I do think it. That said, I do think it's important for on national, state, and local levels that women start being put into leadership, and not just women. We have to have smart, credible women. We, you know, there's sometimes.
So that's not a no.
Caliber.
You're not ruling out a run for Jacksonville mayor, it sounds like.
I, you know, like I said, I'm really focused on my district and focusing on all of the public safety bills that I have in the hopper. And what I try to do to make sure, I mean, one of the issues that I really care deeply about is sex trafficking and sexual assault. And I want to make sure that I am laser focused on that to make the city a safer, better place, and particularly for, you know, my daughter and all the daughters here in Jacksonville.
We're speaking with Jacksonville City Councilwoman Leanna Cumber about a recent workshop she led in the council chambers about hate speech on the First Coast. Jammed up lines for the councilwoman, 549-2937. Eric is in Arlington. Hi, Eric. Good morning.
Good morning. I, with all due respect to your guest, I don't believe it's a messenger problem. I think it's a message problem. I don't know. I don't care who says it. What went on in the Capitol on January 6th, you know, people talk about Black Lives Matter and white supremacy as being like two sides of the same coin, and it's not. And the reason is because Black Lives Matter is based on a real thing. It is a statistical fact which can be proved no matter what sort of statistics or what bureau or government bureau, whatever, that you want to use. As an example, African Americans are more likely to be incarcerated, murdered, and so on and so forth by the state. It's a fact. So Black Lives Matter, when we had all this violence over the summer with Black Lives Matter, it was over something real. What happened on January 6th was violence over something that wasn't real, that the election was stolen. These are completely different things. One thing is real. Black Lives Matter is a real, these people have a real gripe. They have a real complaint, and it can be proved. These other people, what happened on January 6th, white supremacists, on the other hand, do not have a gripe. They are basically rioting. They rioted over something that isn't true. And furthermore, in my neighborhood, my neighbor has a pretty big rebel flag in his yard. And it's obnoxious. I drive by it every day. And I thought about, what does this thing mean? And what that flag really means is that African Americans don't have a place in American history. They don't have a place in our community. And it's once again a denial of the reality that African Americans are part and parcel of the United States. They helped build the country. They are part of the community. They're dug in. They're important, and they matter. And this flag, I have to drive by this flag every day. And the only reason I bring up the flag is you were talking about symbols earlier. You know, I wish this thing would be taken down. I wish the city would make this guy take this thing down because it's obnoxious. And thanks.
All right, Eric. Thank you. Okay, Leanna Cumber. What about this? So many people believing falsely that the election was stolen, and the whole Trumpist movement really is part and parcel of white supremacy. The desire of millions of Americans to hang on to their perceived status as white Americans and resisting the demographic changes that are happening in this country.
So a couple of things. One, I think that to say or to imply that all Republicans who supported former President Trump are white supremacists, I think is completely off base and irrational. I think that it's part of the blame game that I talked about at the beginning. We can compare, there is a group called the Dirtbag Left. They've dubbed themselves that. They have tons of followers. They have podcasts and so forth. They supported Bernie Sanders really heavily. And they also call for violence. They want a socialist world. They call for violence. They were very misogynistic against Hillary Clinton. So nobody has a monopoly on people who are racist or people who are just frankly uninformed, uneducated. But I think that if we continue to focus on, well, they did this or he did this or she did this, rather than say, okay, we need to step back and figure out what's best for our kids. And one of the things that we need to stop doing is having this moral relativism. And I think, you know, this started well before Trump, where for every point, there's a counterpoint.
I think it's a false equivalence to conflate the illiberal left with the authoritarian right. The violence and the extremism you talk about on the left hasn't gained wide purchase inside the mainstream of the Democratic Party, at least not yet. And the Democrats elected a centrist in Joe Biden. On the right, this country elected an extremist white nationalist, and his followers sacked the Capitol in an act of violent insurrection aimed at overturning a free and fair election. And so as a Republican, do you denounce that?
Do I denounce the insurrection of the Capitol?
Yeah.
Of course I do.
And do you denounce Trumpism as an animating force within your own party?
You know, and this is what I said at the beginning, and this is what is so interesting to me, that for me, what I want to do and what many in the party want to do, and I'm not denying that there's a split in the party. I think there's a split in the Democratic Party as well. But what I would like to do is move forward. And when I talk about our policies, I'm talking about school choice. I'm talking about supporting law enforcement and personal security. I'm also talking about economic security. I mean, this pandemic and these shutdowns have almost destroyed an entire generation of working women. I mean, every mm-hmm. month there's been an article talking about this. And to me, those are the things we need to focus on. We need to make sure that people have jobs, and particularly women who have jobs who have spouses and have kids, who don't have kids, who are single moms. Those are the things we need to talk about. And we may get there a different way. And I may, as a Republican, I believe in smaller government and ways to get people there that aren't simply making government bigger and handouts and so forth. But we should all agree that those are the goals that we want. And I think that we have the perfect opportunity right now to start working toward those goals. And if what everyone wants to do is sit and put everyone in their corners and continue to fight, then we just end up doing public policy via Twitter.
Okay. And not to cut you off, Councilwoman, it's just so many people waiting on hold to talk to you. If I could get a couple of them on. Let's go to Marcel in San Marco. Marcel, you're on the air.
Hi, Melissa. This is Marcel, and I agree with the councilwoman there. I believe if you took it to parties, they're being split in quadrants here, and I think some of us in the middle two quadrants kind of are looking for reasonable things to do. And so I agree that, you know, we're pushed into the fractions, but Councilman, there are some things I think immediately, I think you mentioned some goals, and I think it's reasonable to move forward, and it's hard to heal this country. What are some things that maybe both parties can get together on a bipartisan level to actually move forward? Because today we're getting caught in these battles, and Republicans are pushed to the right, and everybody, do you claim this and do you claim that? But I'm looking for progress. Is there, you know, some things that you could do immediately here locally that could also impact nationally some of the politics that are going around, and we actually move forward and try to get something done?
Okay, yeah, thanks for that. Councilwoman Cumber.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. One of the things that in the one of the main reasons that I had this lunch and learn was to start the conversation and start it in a way that we can discuss it, that I can discuss it with my colleagues, we can ask questions, we can have the experts come on and talk about issues, because there are a lot of tough issues that this country is grappling with, and they're not issues that we're ever going to solve on if we're just watching different channels, if we're tweeting about things, if we're on Parler, whatever it is you're on. I'm not on any of them anymore. I haven't looked at Twitter since December. So we need to start talking about these issues in a public forum and not being afraid to have these hard questions, which also means being willing to respect the forum and respect who is speaking, and not, because as soon as we start calling names or start, then we just get pushed to our corners. And I feel like as a country, we have just gone so far in, you know, we've separated so much that the best way to start doing this is from the local level, because we're all neighbors and we should be able to have disagreements and still go out and go to our kids' football games and go have a drink and so forth. So I'm hoping that we can start these conversations, and I intend to have more of these lunch and learns to really, you know, just sit down and have calm conversations.
Let's go to Wells on the South Side. Wells, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. We sort of lost direction here in talking about white supremacist groups. I think the first thing we have to admit to, and your guest has to admit to, is that institutionalized racism exists in America, and that a number of presidents of this country owned Africans and presided over slavery and made the laws that we continue to live under that oppress African Americans. And then presidents lived under 100 years of segregation, which we call Jim Crow. Until these things are addressed, and until the way our kids are educated in school or not educated in school about the history of this country, we're going to be in this fix. We have white supremacist groups that are burning churches, black churches. We know about the killing of the 9 parishioners in the church. So we've got a lot of issues, and we just got out of having a open white supremacist sitting in the White House. And this trial that they had did not bring any of this up, because this is the linchpin that holds this economic system together, and that's racism. Racism and classism, and racism is used to smokescreen the fact that the working class is being super exploited. So when your guest talks about a smaller government, that's a code word to me. That's a dog whistle. That means black people who need help won't get it, and poor white people who need help won't get it. So I'll leave it at that, because there's so much to unpack, and I know you got other people who want to talk.
Let me get in one more call, then we'll close with Councilwoman Cumbert. Nancy in San Jose Forest. Go ahead, Nancy.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I'm so terribly frustrated with the Republican Party just completely ducking the insurrectionists at the Capitol. It's just so frustrating to listen to, and we can't move forward without addressing it. And that's my comment. And this false equivalency with the Black Lives Matter and any other group is ridiculous. That, you know, none of that matters. We have to deal with what went on, the ridiculous lies he told about the election. That has to be dealt with. And we can't keep ducking it. Thank you very much.
Okay. Leanna Cumber, what about that? That there cannot be unity and moving forward as a nation until there's true accountability for what has happened.
Well, I think that if people truly believe we can't move forward, then I think that's a very sad place to be. And I think that that is part of how we got to where we are. And if we cannot move forward, and if people cannot say, we all want to make things better for our neighbors, for our families, for the country, and let's figure out how we can do that and how we can come to agreements, then I think that's a very sad place to be. I don't think we're there. I don't think that...
And not to cut you off, I know you're not on Twitter so much, but getting lots of tweets from listeners saying that they don't feel they can accept the message you're sending about confronting white supremacy unless you accurately define what this phenomenon is in America and denounce it. That there's this sort of wishing away of the reality of white nationalism, authoritarianism, extremism on the right.
I think that there is no wishing away of it if people had watched the Lunch and Learn. There's a difference. Like I said, if there are people who will say that all Republicans are white supremacists, then I can't change their mind. Because if they believe that across the board, if they believe that Tim Scott, who is an African-American Republican from South Carolina, senator, is a white supremacist because he's a Republican, I can't change that. What I can do is have these conversations with my colleagues and in public forums, and I can change how we talk about it in a way that I hope I can change it, that it's not just on Twitter, it's not just yelling at each other, that it's actually sitting down and having a conversation. But if people are going to throw out absolutes that one side is all bad and racist, then there is nothing. Then that person's mind is not going to change, and that person is not going to try to create solutions to make our lives and our city and our state and country better.
Well, I appreciate those thoughts very much. And I do hope that you will return to the show. And I thank you for engaging with everybody here today. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Melissa. Have a great day.
Leanna Cumber of the Jacksonville City Council. And the conversation's not over. Join me on the new Clubhouse app today at 4 o'clock, where we'll continue this conversation. My handle on Clubhouse is at Melissa Injects. 4 o'clock today. Much more coming up later, how you can support D.C.'s Florida House, the only embassy for a state in our nation's capital. But up next.
Lift Jacks is a nonprofit organization with a mission to eradicate generational poverty in Jacksonville. And we're doing that one neighborhood at a time.
Lifting up the city's east side, we speak with the new anti-poverty group Lift Jacks after this. Well, they're a new group working to eliminate poverty on Jacksonville's historic east side. David Garfunkel is the president of Lift Jacks, and he says his organization's goal is to finally break generational poverty in the city, one neighborhood at a time. I spoke with him. Hey, David, thanks so much for being with us. Good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about Lift Jacks. What is this, let me do that again. Tell us about Lift Jacks. What is the mission of this organization?
Sure. Lift Jacks is a nonprofit organization comprised of business leaders, community partners, and local residents with a mission to eradicate generational poverty in Jacksonville. And we're doing that one neighborhood at a time, starting in the east side. And I guess one thing I'd say right off the bat is that one of our guiding principles is that we will never do work to the community, And we're always looking to partner with the community to do work that they want to see in their own neighborhood. And so really what that means is day-to-day, our job is to listen to what residents and community leaders tell us and then identify the partnerships and resources required to bring those desires to life.
And you've identified the East Side neighborhood as the place to begin, or what people that live in the neighborhood call Out East. Why the East?
That's right.
Why the East Side to begin?
Yeah, a couple reasons for that. The first one really is the strong community leadership in Out East. I'm just blown away by the folks who live there, who worship there, who have businesses, really committed to their own revitalization of the neighborhood, and they're really who we partner with day to day. And the second big reason is the momentum in and around the East Side. Certainly, Springfield, we've seen have a resurgence over the last several years. The investments in and around the sports complex, we believe that's going to be helpful to the model. And our job is to channel those investments and momentum and resources in a way that benefits residents of the East Side.
Okay, so tell us about the model of Lift Jacks. It's called Purpose-Built Communities. What is the Purpose-Built Communities model all about?
Right. This is something we're very excited about. So Purpose-Built Communities is a proven model for revitalizing neighborhoods and breaking the cycle of generational poverty. It's nationally recognized at this point, and it's based on the successful holistic revitalization of the East Lake neighborhood outside of Atlanta. And it requires coordinated implementation of four strategies in the neighborhood. So those four are mixed income housing, cradle to career education, community wellness, and long-term financial vitality. And just really briefly, each of those, mixed income housing is about high quality housing that's affordable, as well as market rate. And the second, education, is all about A-plus educational opportunities for the babies, pre-K, all the way up through cradle and college and career. Community wellness is all other aspects that make a community a healthy, vibrant place to live, access to parks, access to healthy food, public safety. And then financial vitality is the economic development, jobs and career pathways, supporting businesses, making it a thriving economic environment. So it's really the holistic set of those strategies all together in the neighborhood that is what Purpose-Built Communities is all about, and that's what we're bringing to bear in the East Side.
Have you already started?
We have. I would say that a little bit on the timeline, we approached East Side leaders at the end of 2019, early 2020, about a year ago, again, to ask their permission if they would be willing to partner with us. And they said, yes, tentatively, conditional that we're at the table. And again, you're doing work that we want to see in our own neighborhood. And so I would say we spent a lot of the last year listening. We wanted to know from local leaders, from community groups, from the nonprofits, from the churches, what they wanted to see. And we've, you know, identified several of those things. And, you know, we did, during COVID, have an opportunity to be responsive to some of the immediate needs that were coming up, partnering, for example, with the historic East Side Community Development Corporation and Feeding Northeast Florida to distribute food, doing things like distributing COVID-19 health information to all the houses. But I would say really a lot of planning this last year and getting excited to implement some of our work this year.
All right. And so how do you measure success on the East Side? What sort of benchmarks will you create to show that Lift Jacks is making a difference?
Yeah, well, you know, that we are here on a mission to eradicate poverty. And so one of the things we look at a top level is poverty rate. And we know that in Jacksonville, the poverty rate is around 13%. And out East, we're talking about over 40%. Families living below the federal poverty line. So over time, and this is not going to happen overnight, we're going to want to see that improve dramatically. But we look at other things, for example, like crime rates. One of the things that I actually, one of the most moving statistics for me is life expectancy. In a neighborhood like the East Side, the average life expectancy is 70 years. If you go down the road 7 miles to a neighborhood like Ortega, the life expectancy is 80 years. So we really are looking at some of these high-level indicators about how we can dramatically improve the quality of life for people. And those are the indicators that we've held ourselves accountable to and that we'll be working on for the next several years.
people do need to mark their calendars to come out to the Eastside Melanin Market on February 27th. That's in honor of Black History Month. Speaking of which, some really incredible African-American figures in history hailed from the East Side, like Eartha White, perhaps the most influential figure from Jacksonville history, James Weldon Johnson, the author of Lift Every Voice and Sing, among many other accomplishments, A. Philip Randolph, father of the Civil Rights Movement. So there's a lot of history in this neighborhood that we need to honor when we talk about this effort. So how can the public get involved in Lift Jacks?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, I think one of the main things to note is that no one organization or person, you know, created poverty, and no one person or organization is going to solve it. And so we really do need all of us rowing in the same direction across sectors to make the improvements we want to see. But I love that lead-in, because one of the things I always ask people to do is to get to know and celebrate the East Side. Please come out to the Melanin Market on February 27th. Actually, the very next day, on February 28th, is Blacknificent, which is an outdoor event showcasing the cuisine of 50 Black and minority-owned restaurants right in the same neighborhood. So we just invite people to get out east, go to the businesses, go to the restaurants, and get to know it. And, of course, you know, if you'd like to learn more about Lift Jacks, you can always visit our website.
LiftJacks.org. He is their new president, David Garfunkel. David, thanks so much for sharing all of this with us.
Thank you, Melissa.
The city of Jacksonville says it will put on a series of public engagement workshops about sea level rise and coastal flooding. Now, the goal of all this activity, which is being hosted by the city's Planning and Development Department, is to raise awareness about neighborhoods all over town and their vulnerability to sea level rise, flooding, and other impacts of climate change. And they also want to get input from all of the community out there on what priorities Jacksonville should have for flood mitigation. WJCT's Brendan Rivers is on the line, and it's the subject of our Going Green today. Hi, Brendan.
Good morning, Melissa.
Okay, so this is coming up. Actually, it's already started, I believe. So tell us a little
tomorrow,
bit.
Tomorrow, I think, is the first
Tomorrow's
one.
The first one. Thank you. Greater Arlington, tomorrow at noon. These are virtual workshops about flooding, sea level rise in neighborhoods across town. Tell us a little bit about how this will be structured.
Well, basically, they've set up this, like, virtual room, and there's a link to it in the store we have at WJCT.org, and it has all these maps and videos and questionnaires and information and stuff, and they're asking people to look through this before they do, they attend one of these workshops. Each of the workshops is going to be done via Zoom, so it should be accessible to most people. You don't have to worry about going somewhere and worry about coronavirus or anything like that. And basically, they're going to talk about community vulnerability and share with people what sort of threats are facing each of these communities in Jacksonville at large. Then they're going to, as you said, they're going to try to get some community input to hear what issues are a priority to the community, and try to get that community feedback on what the city should be doing to help mitigate flooding issues. And there are two of the workshops are kind of like specialty topics, so. The urban core area, each of these are organized by location, by area in Jacksonville. So the urban core workshop is going to be focused on social vulnerability. And then the workshop focused on the Northwest region is going to be focused on historic resources. But otherwise, they're all going to be covering very similar material.
Yeah. Let's talk about how vulnerable Florida and Jacksonville is to flooding and sea level rise. When it comes to flooding, that's not a far-off problem. That's a today problem, Brendan, as we know. And it's only going to increase.
Yeah. I mean, we're clearly already facing flooding issues. I mean, for most people, it might not be an everyday thing, but for some people, it is. Sunny day flooding is becoming more and more frequent in our area. The city's already in the process of buying out a bunch of homes that are in some of these areas that are being flooded on a regular basis. And we know as sea levels rise that that's just going to become more and more of an issue, and it's going to threaten more of our city's infrastructure. It's going to threaten more homes. It's a big issue here, and people may not realize, they might just think it's a coastal issue, but that's definitely not the case. And Jacksonville is very vulnerable because the St. John's River just runs right through the heart of downtown, and it's hundreds of miles long, and it reaches these inland areas, and some of the inland areas actually tend to flood even worse than the coastal areas at times. So this impacts everybody.
By the way, let everyone know that you're reporting on this is at our website, wjct.org, and also at adaptflorida.org, where some of our other contributors like Lisa Gruba and Claire Goforth and others have been reporting on these issues for the city. And Jacksonville is hiring a resiliency person. They're getting serious about this problem. Better late than never. But Jacksonville, Brendan, has lost a lot of time in confronting this issue. We're behind the curve.
Yeah. Yeah, we are definitely behind other major cities in Florida. But as you said, there's been a lot of momentum recently. The city has been doing a lot. In fact, I think next week the Special Committee on Resiliency is scheduled to vote on a bunch of recommendations that are coming from the different subcommittees. So I think it'll be interesting to see what comes from them. And those should end up being policies that the city council will vote on sometime in the near future. So definitely a lot of movement on this, but as you say, we're behind other cities, a lot of catching up to do.
So again, virtual workshops on flooding and sea level rise kicking off tomorrow, with the first one set for noon tomorrow, focusing on Greater Arlington and the beaches, and then upcoming workshops for the Southeast neighborhoods, the urban core, the Southwest, the North, and the Northwest. People can Zoom onto these, Brendan. How can people connect?
So if you go to WJCT.org, find the story, there is one Zoom link for each of these. So it should be very easy to log in and participate in these events. And then if you have more questions or anything, the city planning development department is saying they're open to being reached out to. So feel free to call them.
Right. And that number is 255-7888, the city's planning and development department, to join these workshops on sea level rise and coastal flooding. 255-7888, or as Brendan said, go to wjct.org. Brendan Rivers, who covers environmental issues for us here at the station, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
All right. A quick break, and still to come, it's a unique attraction in our nation's capital, the only embassy that's for a state, the state of Florida. We're going to tell you about Florida House and their brand new campaign as we speak with two local trustees. That's in a moment. You're listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9. We'll be right back.
Join WJCT for the premiere of the new documentary series, The Black Church, with host Henry Louis Gates, featuring Oprah Winfrey, John Legend, Bishop Vashti McKenzie, and many more. Tune in or stream The Black Church February 16th and 17th at 9 p.m. only on WJCT.
To better understand the number of police shootings and racial disparities in the social justice system, Rosa Brooks became a reserve police officer in Washington, D.C. when she was a tenured law professor in her 40s. Her mother, writer and leftist activist Barbara Ehrenreich, disapproved, On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Brooks about her new memoir. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. Journalist Theo Padnos went to cover the Syrian civil war in 2012, but he was captured by an affiliate of Al-Qaeda and held for 2 years. Now he's published a memoir.
I really was persuaded that with the things I was seeing, I would never be able to tell to anybody, but they let me go.
Theo Padnos and the latest news next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
National news gets a lot of attention, but local media manages to break some of the biggest stories. From New Jersey's Bridgegate to the Boston priest scandal, some of America's most staggering injustices were first revealed through local journalism. Big stories dug up from the ground up. That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Well, it's a unique attraction in the nation's capital. Florida House is the only embassy of its kind for any state in the union. Local trustees for Florida House say they're recruiting and fundraising right now for summer and fall interns at this unique house in Washington, D.C. By the way, you can get a free glass of orange juice there if you're visiting Washington and you're a Florida resident. Two local trustees, Martha Barrett and Mike Hightower, join me on Zoom Monday to tell us all more. All right, let's start with you, Mike Hightower. Both you and Martha are trustees for Florida House. Let's first explain what Florida House is. Tell us all about Florida House.
Florida House was started in 1972 by the late Rhea Chiles, who was the wife of then U.S. Senator Lawton Chiles. Florida House is a three-story Victorian townhouse that sits directly behind the U.S. Supreme Court. And from our window, we can see the U.S. Capitol. And Rhea bought this house so that Floridians who come to Washington can have a place to meet and celebrate and visit Florida. And most importantly, have a glass of orange juice.
Right. I've heard about that.
And when you're there in the summertime, trust me, it's really nice to go into an air-conditioned building and have a glass of good Florida orange juice.
So, yeah, it's almost like an embassy for Florida residents.
That's right.
Is that right, Martha?
We are the only state in the entire United States that has an embassy in Washington, D.C.
Yeah. Martha, that is kind of a cool thing. And so people can take advantage of that when they're visiting. You and Mike are in the business of raising money for Florida House, getting the word out about Florida House. Mm-hmm. What's happening with Florida House right now?
Well, I want to just say that this is a nonpartisan group. And everything raised for Florida House is non-governmental. No state money goes into Florida House. So it's all volunteers and voluntary money. It's really a wonderful organization. And again, we're the only state in the whole country that has such a place in Washington, D.C.
Yeah. And so now that people listening, they know the next time they're in Washington, they should definitely stop by Florida House. It costs money to maintain this beautiful home, and so there's a campaign going on right now. Is that right, Martha?
Yes, there is. I'll let Mike explain better than I can, but it's really a neat letter-writing campaign. And, Mike, I'll turn it to you on that one.
Thank you, Martha. Just for our region is Northeast Florida, which is Nassau, Duval, Clay, St. John's County. And we have a group of extraordinary ladies and gentlemen. And because of COVID, we are soliciting funds, one, to maintain the house. We have five employees. But this year, our emphasis is on our internship program. And because we are the only embassy, the only state that has an embassy in Florida, we provide an 8-week opportunity for sophomore, juniors, or seniors in college to come to Washington and be an intern. They spend 3 days in at Florida House and then 2 days in one of the congressional offices. And as Martha said, we are nonpartisan and we are there. And so our internship program, we look for outstanding sophomore, juniors, or senior college students who want to come and enhance their understanding and hopefully encourage them to have a career in Washington, but have a career in government. We also, part of that started out as Florida House also encourages civics to be taught in high school. So we are all about what is good about our country and what is good about government. So we are doing a fundraiser for our internship program for the upcoming summer and for the fall.
Okay. So, Martha, how can people support your efforts and contribute?
Well, certainly they can go to www.floridahouse.org to see what we do. And certainly, Mike, how would they send any donations that anyone Correct. Would like to do?
Yes, and the important thing, Melissa, is that we are a 501c organization. So any donations that we do, because we are education-oriented, it is a tax deduction. So we have been able to maintain Florida House since 1972 through private donations, but it's a tax. You get a tax deduction for that. So it's maintaining the only embassy in Washington. But this year it is all about sending qualified sophomore, junior, and senior students to Washington, D.C. for an 8-week seminar program. So we encourage you all to support Florida House.
Go to floridahouse.org for more. Trustees Martha Barrett and Mike Hightower, thanks to you both.
Thank you, Melissa.
You.
Quick correction, that's actually floridahousedc.org. Florida House, the State Embassy of Florida. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks so much for listening. And join me on Clubhouse, the new audio app, today at 4 o'clock for a discussion of what's next for the 904. My handle is @MelissaInJax. Have a great day, everyone.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.